Last week, we talked about what was kind of above the line, the way we had drawn it on the board, talking about salvation, damnation, and I promised this week to talk, or at least introduce some of the thoughts about how it all fits together from the standpoint of being lost or damned. And I'll tell you how this kind of came to me. Several years ago, I read N.T. Wright's book, Surprised by Hope, which is a really good read and not a hard read at all. And I think the Kindle version's like $10, and every once in a while it goes on sale. Highly recommended. But Surprised by Hope deals with the heaven part of the discussion, the salvation part of the discussion. And although Wright talks a little bit about damnation, not much. And frankly, I don't entirely agree with what he says. And he basically says, I'm not real sure about it myself. I hadn't got that part worked out entirely. So the book is almost entirely about what happens to the saved. And it teaches the idea that we've talked about, which is at the end of this age, rather than going up to heaven and the earth being destroyed, the earth is purified by fire. And then we enter the new heavens and new earth, which is the old earth restored, refreshed, recreated, purified, redeemed. And redeemed's a pretty good word. It's the word Paul uses in Romans 8 to talk about what's going to happen. And then we're not, the scriptures are very unclear. They just don't really address the question much at all as to what happens in between my death and the general resurrection. Because there's going to be a resurrection at the end of time. 1 Corinthians 15 is very clear about this, but lots of passages are clear about this. That doctrine goes back at least to Daniel chapter 12. There'll be a resurrection, but what happens between now and then? Well, if you ask Paul, he normally talks about the saved who are no longer alive as being asleep. He'll talk about those who are asleep in Christ. By that he means saved people who have died. So it's a euphemism, right? But he doesn't talk about the damned as being asleep. He doesn't really tell us where they are. There's even less about that. Jesus, when he talks about the fate of the... Well, let me come back to that. So, if the earth's going to be purified by fire, and if what we typically think of as heaven, and there is a heaven, of course, but in Revelation 21:22, heaven, which is sometimes called in the New Testament the New Jerusalem, sometimes called paradise or the garden, if it descends to join the earth and the earth is purified and they become one so that God may now dwell with man on earth, and if the meek inherit the earth, which Jesus promised, then where does hell kind of fit in this picture? And so at the end of reading Wright's book, the question came to me, that's the question that came to me is, well, where is hell? You know, right? Because heaven and earth are consolidated, they're merged. And if Wright is right, God and man have come together and everything is united. And there's been a fire that destroyed all the evil and purged all about the world that is wrong and left only what is right. And we read about that in lots of places, but I particularly find clear 1 Corinthians chapter 3, where Paul says, you know, I planted, Apollos water, God gave the increase. And if you build with hay and straw and wood, some people might build with jewels and silver and gold. But when the fire, when the end comes, your work will be tested by fire. And if you built with wood, hay or whatever, it's going to be burned up, consumed. But you'll escape, although as one barely escaping through fire. Now you'll smell like smoke. But if you build out of jewels and gold and silver, then not only do you survive the fire, but what you built survives the fire. And so that's how Paul sees the end of time, as a moment of purging and purifying and destroying everything that doesn't measure up to God's standards. Well, there's at least one fire in Paul's world, one of them being the consumption of the unredeemed parts of the world, right? Then where's hell? And it doesn't really fit quite right. So realizing that, I had on my shelf a book by Edward Fudge called The Fire That Consumes, which I had bought and never read, because as soon as I bought it, I regretted my decision because I knew this couldn't possibly be right. Why waste my time? But now it kind of fit, I thought. And Fudge's story is an interesting story. I will admit to a little bit of prejudice, because Fudge has all the marks of greatness. He's a Church of Christ elder. He's a lawyer. He has a bad back. He grew up in North Alabama, very conservative church, and he kind of studied his way out of that. And we've corresponded over the years now. Edward grew up non-institutional. We used to say anti-institutional. We used to call them antis, right? So North Alabama, conservative, no matter what kind of Church of Christ you're in, if you're in the non-institutional branch, you're really conservative. And he grew up the son of a preacher, and went to Florida College and started having, you know, those kinds of thoughts that come to people who read your scriptures and realize that maybe what have they were taught as a child didn't quite fit. He and his dad had various discussions on that. And after he graduated college, Florida College, by the way, is where is the church school for the non-institutional folks. He went to Florida College and then went back, and his dad had a publishing business, because I mean, he was a Church of Christ preacher, right? That's how you make your living, publishing business. So he worked for his dad, published a standard column, which was, you know, more intelligent than most, and got noticed by, I think it's a Jehovah's Witness, I may be mistaken, but by a man of another denomination who believed that we have misunderstood the doctrine of hell. And he saw in Fudge an honest, brilliant man, which is correct, and said, I'll pay you if you'll study this doctrine and write a book. He thought, well, what's better than getting paid money than to study and write a book? So he did that. Ultimately published The Fire That Consumes, which is a phrase taken from the Law of Moses, speaking of God's fire on Mount Sinai, but it's repeated throughout Scripture all the way into Hebrews. And came to the conclusion, which is technically known as conditionalism. Some would say annihilationism, but that's too hard to say and to spell. So we prefer conditionalism. And his view is immortality, we are not innately immortal. Nowhere in the Bible does it talk about an immortal soul. The soul in the Jewish worldview is a part of the human. We're not a dualistic spirit and body. We're all one thing. We have a spirit, we have a soul, we have a body, but they're not radically different pieces of that get assembled. They're one thing in God's mind, in this Jewish mind. The soul is given immortality if it's been saved. And if you look up the word mortal and immortal in your concordances or in the back of your Bible and go flip to all those verses, there's about a half dozen verses in the New Testament that use one word or the other. And every one of them says either humans are mortal or God is immortal or even that God is the only immortal. But it says specifically in 1 Timothy and in Romans that God gives immortality to the saved. So the New Testament teaching pretty clearly, actually, and I had never heard this. I'd probably read it 500 times and it had just come right past me because it wasn't part of my worldview. It's not how I saw the world. But immortality is a gift by God to the saved. And that's plainly taught at the end of 1 Corinthians 15. All right. Well, if that's true, then the damned aren't necessarily immortal. Could be. God can make them immortal, should he so choose. But they don't have to be. Plato and the Greeks taught that the soul is by nature immortal. But that was not a biblical teaching. All right, so that's point one from Fudge. Point two is the scriptures teach that if you die and you are damned, that what happens to you is you are punished and then destroyed. And repeatedly, the scriptures say you are destroyed. We take destroyed to mean not destroyed. And the scriptures repeatedly say, and at this point, you will perish, the eternal death. Or Revelation calls it the second death. And we take death, that to mean don't die. So that when Satan said to, or the serpent said to Eve in the garden, if you eat this, you will surely die, he lied. In fact, you will live forever. It will be a very unpleasant existence. You will live in conscious, eternal torment, but you will live. You see? So the conventional teaching within the church, not just Churches of Christ, but Christianity in general, and this goes back to about the 3rd century, is that the fate of the damned is eternal conscious torment, right? But that means you never die. You never suffer a second death. You might suffer the first death and then, you know, live forever in torment, but you certainly don't suffer a second death. But Revelation talks about the second death. Paul says that when you die, and Jesus says when you die and you're damned, you will then perish, by which we think he means live forever in torture. But that's a really odd way to say live forever being tortured, right? No matter what position you take, you got to admit that it's odd how the scriptures talks about what the idea of eternal conscious torment. And then there's more, they're bigger to me, kind of questions of conscience about how that would be. Because in our traditional teaching, if a child is born innocent and not accountable, if they die, they go to heaven, live with Jesus forever. And then at some point, and we're not real sure when, but at some point, the child reaches what's called the age of accountability. Right? Now, that phrase, age of accountability, goes back all the way to the 15th century, 16th century, to a guy named Jacob Arminius. And Arminius was the guy who said Calvin is wrong on all 5 points. And rather than being born in sin and going to be damned when you're born, original sin, total depravity, you're born innocent and unaccountable. Was Arminius' point of view. But you come to a point in your life where you are accountable, of course. We eventually reach adulthood. In Churches of Christ, we tend to think of that as being around age 12, although we got no basis for that at all in Scripture, but it's as good a number as any. And Jesus went to the temple and studied with the rabbis at age 12, but that doesn't mean he became accountable. I mean, two very different questions, right? And if you've raised any children, you know they're capable of willful, rebellious disobedience. At what age?
2.
Certainly by 2. I got a 2-year-old granddaughter. You go check on Facebook. She's less than 2 and a half. She says to her mother, they're at Government Plaza downtown. There's a fountain. She says, I want coins, dough, and fountain. Okay. Gives you a couple of pennies. And she then does a cannonball into the fountain with the coins in her hand. So not only is she capable of disobedience, she's capable of rationalizing. She's a fifth generation lawyer potentially. So we've got pictures on Facebook of her jumping right into that fountain, coins in her hands like this. She's not about to give up those coins and keep the coins, but she is going in the fountain. So I don't know, is that sin? I don't know, but is she accountable? I don't think so. But at what age does it go from cute and innocent to damnable? Well, in theory, let's say you turn 12, you die the night before, you go straight to heaven, live with Jesus in eternity. Next night, you think one lustful thought, or you're mean to your brother, or you don't make up your bed, and you die, haven't been baptized yet, you go straight to hell, you suffer an eternity of torment. Whoa, that sounds really harsh. Right? I mean, it's easy to imagine Hitler suffering an eternity of torment. We're good with that. I mean, he worked hard to deserve his punishment. But a middle schooler? But for everybody is the same in the traditional view. And it just seems, we don't think about it because it's so ingrained in us. We learned about it, many of us, from when we were in diapers. You don't really give it a fresh thought. But if you do think about it, it does seem unfair that, a child who dies at 13 or 12, not yet baptized, is suffering the identical punishment as, Stalin, who let 5 million people die of starvation, or Hitler, who killed 6 million Jews, or Mao Zedong, who can't count the people he allowed to die, So a lot of non-Christians and a lot of Christians struggle with this doctrine for good reason, I think. And part of the real problem from an evangelistic perspective is our usual kind of our pitch, our sales pitch for Christianity is first, you're damned and going to hell, you need to be forgiven. Oh, I'm not a Christian, I never heard about this, about hell, tell me about hell. Oh, well, if you've committed even one sin, you're going to spend eternity in conscious torment. Oh, well, God is a terrible person. Why would he do such a thing to anybody? That's not right. That's not fair. See? And we got to own it. Right? I mean, you can't just pretend it's not there. It's there. Let me give you a verse. Luke chapter 12. Help us in the right place. Here we go. All right. Help me out. I'm looking for the passage that says, here it is. Got it. Let's start at verse 41. Peter said, Lord, are you telling this parable for us or for all? And the Lord said, who then is the faithful and wise manager whom his master will set over his household to give them their portion of food at the proper time? Blessed is that servant whom his master will find so doing when he comes. Truly I say to you, he will set him over all his possessions. But if that servant says to himself, my master is delayed in coming, and begins to beat the male and female servants and to eat and drink and get drunk, the master of that servant will come on the day when he does not expect him, and an hour he does not know, and he will cut him in pieces and put him with the unfaithful. Ooh. And that servant who knew his master's will, but did not get ready or act according to his will, will receive a severe beating. And the one who did not know and did what deserved a beating will receive a light beating. Everyone to whom much was given, of him much will be required. And from him to him they entrusted much, they will demand the more. So, in very graphic language, Jesus says some people are going to be punished more than other people. And part of the standard for how badly you're going to be punished is your level of accountability, what you knew. I mean, to some extent, you should know not to abuse the master servants. You really shouldn't have to have somebody tell you that. But if you were told that and abused them, you're going to be punished all the worse. Now, how does that fit into an eternity of torment? How can some people be punished less and some people punished more if everybody is punished forever? You see? Problem. Not this insuperable, but it's a problem. Now, so Fudge has concluded that the damned will be punished in eternity, you know, in the next world, in the next age, but it will be a finite punishment. It will be whatever is just. Now, you know, God will decide that, and I trust God to decide what is just. I've heard people say, oh, well, that's unfair. No, by definition, it's fair because it's whatever God says is fair, right? If you don't think it's fair, then it's not God. You don't have a good kind. But God will punish people. It is finite, and at the end of that time of punishment, they cease to exist. And then it's over. They die the second death. They perish. They're destroyed. Now, I never heard that growing up. Didn't hear that at Lipscomb when I was there. Actually, it's now very much in the literature being discussed among the scholars a lot today. It's a very hot topic. So if you go look on the internet and search the word conditionalism, you'll find many denominations, many different scholars debating this from both perspectives. I mean, it's all over the place, which is good. It's a good conversation for us to have. If that's right, that fits this picture very nicely, because the same fire that purges the earth of what's imperfect and unredeemed and not ready, that will also purge those people. But the punishment each one suffers will not be an eternal torture. It will be a finite torture proportional to whatever guilt and accountability they have, as judged individually by God, which is fair. Right? Now, it doesn't mean, therefore, we don't need to go evangelize the lost, because it's still going to be punishment, and it's going to be awful. And if you read the passages about Gehenna in the Gospels, Jesus makes it really clear, you do not want to go there, you will not like this, it's going to be just awful. Okay, you don't need to rationalize it and think it's not that bad. No, Jesus makes it plainly clear, it is that bad. God's wrath suffering that will be not fun at all. It just won't be grossly out of proportion to the sins committed. So that's part of the appeal of the position. Let me just read you several verses. Matthew 7:13. Enter by the narrow gate, for the gate is wide, and the way is easy that leads to destruction. And those who enter it are many, for the gate is narrow, and the way is hard that leads to life, and those who find it are few. You take your concordance and go look for the word destruction for wherever it appears in the Bible, see what it means. Well, when it's not talking about the destruction of the damned, it's used to things like destroying a city or a kingdom, right? Which doesn't mean when God says, I'm going to destroy Edom, or I'm going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, he doesn't mean I'm going to torture them forever and they're not going to be destroyed. I'm going to keep them around just so I can keep torturing them. That word means destroyed like we in English use destroyed. destroyed is a good interpretation. Matthew 10:28, and do not fear those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul. Rather fear him who can destroy both body and soul in hell, Gehenna. Well, under the traditional view, God doesn't destroy our body in hell. Our body stays in the grave and our soul goes to hell. And God doesn't destroy our soul. He just tortures it forever if we're damned. Right? But under the conditionalist view, we die, we're resurrected, both body and soul then meet their fate, either in the new heavens and new earth or in Gehenna. Oh, which brings us to Gehenna. Jesus, the word hell appears nowhere in the Greek or Hebrew. There's no such word. The word that Jesus uses for hell is Gehenna. Sometimes Hades is translated hell, but that's only in the King James, pretty much. Because Hades doesn't mean hell. I mean, Hades means wherever the dead are, both good dead, bad dead, saved dead, lost dead, all dead are in Hades. It's just the grave or the realm of the dead. Whereas hell translates to Greek or the Aramaic Gehenna, and Gehenna is a place outside of Jerusalem, which is a garbage dump, which was a constant fire. You know, smelled bad, was bad, was nasty. And it's where unclean, filthy things were dumped. And it's interesting that if Jesus wants to introduce to the people a brand new concept, because there's no references to hell or Gehenna in the Old Testament. Well, there is Gehenna, but it's a physical location, right? There is no hell in the Old Testament. So if Jesus shows up and says, I want to introduce you to this new concept, odd that he would use the garbage dump as a physical, real place as his metaphor for hell. Even more odd that Paul never says the word Gehenna, ever. He only speaks in terms of destruction and death. Never talks about a place. Romans 9:22. What if God, desiring to show his wrath and to make known his power, has endured with much patience vessels of wrath prepared for destruction, in order to make known the riches of his glory for vessels of mercy, which he has prepared beforehand for glory? So Paul, he's talking about God's wrath and the consequences of being in God's wrath. The word he uses is destruction. 1 Corinthians 3:17. If anyone destroys God's temple, God will destroy him. For God's temple is holy, and you are that temple. Now, he uses destroy twice, right? Once for what I might do to a local church, destroy it by dividing it. And once for what God will do to me if I do that, which is eternal torture. No. If they both mean destroy in both places, it means destroy. And then there are dozens. I wouldn't begin to want to try to read them all, but get your concordances and get a Bible Gateway on the internet, probably the easiest place. Just look up the word destruction or destroy and see how it's used in the Bible. And for that matter, you can look up perish or imperishable or perishing. But when Paul, now, and then real quick, one last point. Plato wrote a book. Now, Plato predates Paul by about 300 years, but Plato is the guy that everybody studied in school if you were Greek or Roman, right? Everybody read their Plato. He wrote a book on the immortality of the soul, and he made a list of things that cannot happen to a human soul. One of them is it cannot perish, it cannot be destroyed. And we can't see it in English, but there's about four different words for destroy in Greek. Plato uses all four to say cannot happen. Paul, in his letters, uses all four to say will happen. So if you wanted to say to a Greek audience, I agree with Plato and the soul will last forever, why on earth would you negate every statement Plato says about the immortality of the soul? can't perish, can't be destroyed. See? Whereas Plato is teaching, Plato says can't perish, can't be destroyed, whereas Paul is saying it will be destroyed and it will perish. Now, we want to read it and say, well, it's a metaphor, and Paul is using destroy and perish as a euphemism for eternal conscious torment, which, you know, is not impossible. But his Greek readers would not have read him that way. That would be a very backwards way of expressing yourself to people with a Greek background. And that's kind of, for me, the point where I said, maybe I need to read the rest of this book, you know? So that's just the thinnest of introductions to the idea, but that's the concept that Fudge teaches. I find myself tending to agree with, because I think it makes better sense of God. I think if I'm talking to a lost person, it's easier to say God justly damns and condemns people with a fair and proportional punishment. It's consistent with the character of God as revealed in Scripture, and it's what the words say. Now, as is true of every theory you want to pick, right? It's easy to find some verses that seem to point you the other way. I'm not going to sit here and tell you there are no passages that are difficult. What I will say is, I don't care what theory you pick, you're going to have difficult passages, right? There are fewer difficult passages going with Fudge's conditionalism than there are with any other theory that I can find. And there's really only one or two that are even worth spending a whole lot of time to struggle with. And most of those, when you read the Old Testament background they're quoting, it comes clear what's really meant, and they're not a problem at all. Just that we don't tend to do that. So I'm sorry if I haven't gone over time, but that's kind of the big picture. See you next week.
Yeah, I have a question.
Sure.
We talk about heaven and earth being restored, it being redeemed. But then earlier you talked about the parts of the earth which is damnable.
Yes.
If the earth is going to be restored to its natural state, what part is damnable? What part is going to be destroyed?
Well, part of that will be the people who are damned.
So it's the people.
Yeah, I'd say that is the clearest teaching, right? And that's kind of common ground for all the commentators, right? At least it's the people, right? God's going to purge the earth of the wickedness of the earth and the people who are wicked, right? Beyond that, it's hard to say, because what we do know, Romans 8 says the earth is groaning in anticipation of this, and it's going to be free from its bondage to futility and decay. Well, it means something more than just the damned people will go away. I mean, the creation itself was frustrated and subjected to futility and penalties because of the fall of man. And if you read Genesis 3 that way, well, it wasn't just that women were going to have more pain and men have to work harder, but the earth was going to put forth weeds, and you know, the planet itself seems to have been judged and condemned. That's the wrong way to put it. Planet itself seems to have suffered from the curse. And so some parts of it are going to change. And it's going to get better. Personally, my money's on poison ivy. You know, I can't think of any good reason to have poison ivy.
No mosquitoes.
Certainly no mosquitoes.
Those things were only created after the fall.
Well, actually, I don't think so, but that's a whole, I mean, we got. the exact.
I'm not sure why the earth should be punished, the earth itself.
It seems unfair, doesn't it?
Perfect,
yes.
And he's going to restore it to its perfectness.
Yes.
Part of what I think about is, you know, the cleansing, purifying fire, forest fires that are, you know, used to renew the forest, you know, to do a whole lot more good than we then spent 100 years trying to stop them, now the last 30, 40 years discovered it actually has purpose.
Yeah, but it may be nothing more than the damage that we've done to the earth will get fixed, right? I mean, we've made a mess of things. There are plenty of places that are pretty messed up by humanity. And you're right, it's probably, I don't think that would have been in Romans 8, Paul seems to be speaking about, you know, the fallenness of the earth itself, of the creation itself. Some people put that in terms of entropy, that things fall apart, they break, they wind down. The nature of this world is built deep into the physics of this world, that it is a dying universe. Right? It's not just human death or animal death. Stars die, galaxies die, black holes die, everything dies. And according to the physicists, it will all unwind and become cold and die and be nothing. Well, we can't live forever in that universe. Something's got to be changed, right? God's got to have a way to constantly re-energize it. But what the physics of the new universe will be, I do not know, you know. But I know that the problem of entropy has to be solved, or else we can't live in it forever. It'll unwind. The sun will go out eventually. It'll be a long time, but it will go out. The earth will run out of fossil fuel pretty quickly. You know, there's only so much ability to sustain life in the universe as it presently exists. And so the laws of physics themselves have to be restructured. Or God has to re-empower and reignite the flames with his own power, which is possible too, you know. But we're not told. But that is, you know, the commentators don't spend much time on this question because we don't really have much of an answer, but at least anybody's thought of, but that's part of it, is the innate finiteness and inability of the world to last forever on its own. So we can't be promised a world that does last forever without God changing things. All right, thanks.